Now, by any measure, that really swings. And it also gets our attention big time. That's a lot of music. It fills a lot of space, and we're going to expect a drama as big, as swollen, as dramatic as that overture gives us, and we will indeed get it. Now, at the heart of the drama, at the heart of the opera, lies Orpheus, the character. And at the heart of Orpheus, the character, lies his ultimate inability to control himself. The chorus of spirits that concludes Act 4, this is after Orpheus has failed and lost Eurydice, sings this. Orpheus overcame hell and was overcome by his passions. Eternal fame is deserved only by him who will have victory over himself. Let's talk about Orpheus, the character, please. I quote from Joseph Kerman's wonderful book, Opera as Drama. Myths contain in them the lasting problems of humankind. The myth of Orpheus, furthermore, deals with a person specifically as artist, and one is drawn inevitably to see in the Orpheus myth the peculiar problems of the opera composer. Initially, Orpheus is the supreme lyric artist, but for Orpheus, the lyric singer, the crisis of life becomes the crisis of his lyric art. Art must now move into action onto the tragic stage of real life. What Kerman is talking about, of course, is that Orpheus can go around singing all he likes. That's art. But when he decides to go to Hades and use his singing to bring back Eurydice, art must now intrude into the action of real life. It is a sublime attempt. Can its symbolic boldness have escaped the musicians of 1600, seeking a new power in new forms of drama? Orpheus's new triumph is to fashion the lament that harrows hell out of his own great sorrowing emotion. This, too, the early opera composers must have identified with, wrestling as they were with new emotional means, harrowing, dangerous to manage. But the fundamental conflict of the myth transcends that time and this medium and extends to every artist. It is the problem of emotion and its control. Orpheus, as an artist, achieves everything. He changes hell with his art of song. But as a man, he cannot shape his emotions to Pluto's shrewd challenge. Face to face with the situation, he looks back and fails. Real life and art are not necessarily one. Unquote. Now, that Monteverdi and Alessandro Striggio were aware of this allegorical relationship between Orpheus the man and the problems of the librettist and composer is revealed immediately in the prologue, which follows the toccata we just heard. So let's move on to the prologue, please. The prologue begins with a ritornello. A ritornello. A ritornello is a musical refrain. The word ritornello comes from the Italian ritornare, which means to return to. So a ritornello is a refrain, a melody that comes back and back and back again. This gorgeous and melancholy instrumental refrain will return time and time again across the span of the opera. So it's very important we get it in our ears now so that we hear it and recognize it when it returns at later times. Please, just the ritornello theme that initiates the prologue. Now, this striking and memorable ritornello appears at the end of Act Two, right after Orpheus is determined to go to Hades. It appears at the beginning of Act Five, after Orpheus has failed in his mission. And it becomes a sort of leitmotif, symbolizing the melancholy of the story, the power of music, as it is expressed right here in lines 5 and 6. At lines 5 and 6 of the prologue, I am music who with sweet sounds knows how to calm every troubled heart. And this is the music that represents all of these elements. So it's an important chunk of music, and we'll hear it again in just a moment. But please, let me read through the prologue, and we will hear it in its entirety. Yes, this is the voice of La Musica introducing us to the story and the characters. We have 5 verses. The first verse, I suppose, is the expected obsequious one that says, thank you to all the royal people who have come and commissioned this work. From my beloved Parnassus, I come to you, illustrious heroes of noble royal blood. Yes, she's speaking right to the Gonzagas. Whose glorious virtues are proclaimed by fame only incompletely, for they are too many to number. Oh, my goodness. All right, this obsequious tushy smooching out of the way, La Musica can now get on to rather more important topics. And now, in verse 2, she stops being accompanied by a harpsichord and starts being accompanied by one of those chitarroni, which sounds just like a lyre. So now we hear, in many ways, the voice of Orpheus. I am music, who with sweet sounds knows how to calm every troubled heart, and now to noble anger, now to love, can kindle the most icy souls. The ritornello returns again. Verse 3. Singing to the golden lyre, I am accustomed sometimes to delight mortal ears, and I thus inspire the soul at the sonorous harmony of the lyre of heaven. Ritornello. Verse 4. My desire now is to tell you of Orpheus who held the wild beast spellbound with his song. And when she sings that, please, I want you to notice this gorgeous violin elaboration. It is the voice of Orpheus in the background, who even subdued hell with his pleading, and who won the immortal fame of Pindos and Helicon. Again the ritornello. Now during my song, verse 5, now gay, now sad, may the birds be silent on these trees. No waves be heard on these shores, and every breeze should cease to blow. What she's saying here in verse 5, she's saying, keep it down out there. No noise, just shut up and listen. That's a great verse. To end the introductory music with a stern warning, let everything be quiet while I tell you this story. And then we hear the ritornello 2 more times. The last thing I would point out, because I am intellectually bound to do so, is that this entire prologue is a passacaglia. That is, the melody of each of these 5 verses is different, but the baseline, the underpinning, is the same over and over and over again. Do I expect you to notice that? No. Would a fellow composer notice that? Yes, instantaneously. I need to point out these things because we need to know what a great technician Monteverdi is, aside from being a great dramatist. This work succeeds at every level, my friends, technical, aesthetic, dramatic. All right, let's jump in. Let us listen to this marvelous prologue, which begins again with the ritornello, which will come and punctuate each of the 5 verses. All right, we're ready for Act One. Act One is about happiness and joy in Eden or Arcadia or Sylvania. Call it whatever you want, just don't call it North Jersey. The opening recitative is sung to us by a shepherd, and it reflects the joyful and dancing spirit of this opening act. And it also gives us a chance to talk about the nature of Monteverdi's recitative, which is so different from Peri's or Caccini's. First, I would read what the shepherd sings to us. On this happy, auspicious day, which has put an end to the lovesickness of our demigod, let us sing, shepherds, in such gentle accents that our strains will be worthy of Orpheus. Today, pity has stirred the soul, till now so disdainful of the lovely Eurydice. Today, Orpheus has been made happy on her breast, for whose sake he has already sighed and wept so much in these woods. So what is the shepherd saying? Well, Eurydice has finally said, yes, all right, okay, I'll marry you. Now, leave me alone. Yes, we can imagine that Orpheus has wept and sighed and sung and has finally convinced her, and everyone, including Eurydice herself, is filled with joy. And our shepherd continues to repeat his first lines again on this happy, auspicious day, and so forth and so on. I want us to listen to this opening recitative, these first moments of Act One, and I want us, most importantly, to compare the sense of depth, melodic spirit, and musicality of this recitative to what we heard in Peri's Eurydice, which I think we admitted was, oh, if Peri's Eurydice was food, it would be a saltine cracker with nice brook water. All right, what food, then, might this recitative by Monteverdi be?
In questo lieto e fortunato giorno che ha posto fine agli amorosi affanni del nostro semideo, cantiam pastori il siso a piacenti che sian degni d'Orfeo concedenti. Oggi fatta e pietosa, l'alba già si sdegnosa della pelle unidice. Oggi fatto e felice Orfeo nel sen di lei, per cui già tanto per queste selve cantiam pastori il siso a viacenti che sian degni d'Orfeo nostri concedenti.
Now that's nice. It moves, it has melodic contour, there's a sense of directionality, there's a real sense of musical substance here that goes way beyond anything we heard in the Peri. If this was food, all right, it might not be Chateaubriand with an old and fine Bordeaux yet. We'll get to that in due time. But certainly there's enough substance here to feed us and feed us happily. Yeah, this is a whole different story than the kind of recitative we heard in the earlier operas. It's almost song, but not quite. And this is Monteverdi's recitative. Really much closer to song, a harmonic underpinning that pushes the music forward, a sense of melody and contour that gives this life. One might call this arioso, and often Monteverdi's recitative is called arioso, almost song-like, arioso, not to be confused with Aristotle Onassis. Joseph Kerman writes of Monteverdi's particular form of recitative. Recitative was Monteverdi's greatest achievement. It forms the basis for Orfeo and completely dominates and determines his masterpiece of 35 years later, The Coronation of Poppea. Recitative is one of the fundamental, constant elements of operatic dramaturgy. But actually, it already began to decay into convention with Monteverdi's pupils, and in spite of impressive renewals in later centuries, it has never again been used with Monteverdi's confidence, imagination, and conviction. As a result, it's hard for us today to think of recitative as anything but second best, as a necessary link between arias. I would point out that in 1600, there was as of yet no concept of abstract instrumental musical expression that was not tied to words, the sort of expression we hear in, let's say, a Bach organ work or in a Beethoven symphony. In the musical tradition that Monteverdi grew up with, musical expressivity, as we know, had been tied to word painting, as in the madrigals that we've listened to. Joseph Kerman continues. Now, there was a new, specifically neoclassic ideal. Music should imitate the accents of passionate speech as represented by the grand, exaggerated rhetoric of a great actor. Music should follow the cadence and thus the moving implications of the individual word. The result was a recitative, tumbling emotion, a continuing heart cry, undistanced, the naked human voice behind the measured voice of the poet. Its magnificence and immediacy stem from its impulsive nature, from its lack of formal control. Monteverdi met this ideal of recitative with a perfect genius for declamation. Words formed themselves musically for him. And to whip the recitative line into passion, he harrowed every available musical means for tension. Declamation guided him to sudden halts and spurting cascades of rhythm, and to precipitous, intense rises and falls in his melodic lines. This art of recitative is what Monteverdi brought to the story of Orpheus, an artist who could move hell by his grief, a lover who could not dominate his passions. Let us continue. We hear a chorus of nymphs and shepherds, which will allow us now a brief insight into the nature of symbolism in Alessandro Strigio's libretto. Now, following that just-heard recitative, we hear a chorus of nymphs and shepherds sing a joyful congregational prayer in honor of Orpheus and Eurydice. And here's what they sing. Come, Hymen, O come, and let thy blazing torch be like a rising sun that brings days of serenity to these lovers and drive far away the horrors and the shadows of anguish and grief. It's kind of like a toast to their impending marriage. Let's just listen to this brief chorus, and then let's talk about the symbolism inherent in these words.
Yeah.
All right. This seemingly inconspicuous little chorus is filled with the sort of symbolism that absolutely permeates this entire opera. Mythological Orphic doctrine states that the sun equals divine truth, goodness, and masculinity. Again, the sun equals divine truth, goodness, and masculinity. Machismo. With this concept of masculine machismo in our ears, let me read you the opening lines again, and let's see how innocent these words are. Come, Hymen, and let thy blazing torch be like a rising sun that brings days of serenity to these lovers. Yo, this is not just sun worship, but clearly phallic and reproductive symbolism as well. And we thought that it was going to be safe to let the kids watch this, huh? No, warning label music, hide them. Let's continue. Now, of course, the references to the sun, which are many here in the first act, and the brightness of the upper world, stand in sharp contrast with the shadowy darkness of the underworld, where the great drama of Orpheus and Eurydice will eventually be played out. Robert Donington points out, opera started at a period, the late Renaissance, when deliberate symbolism was at the very height of fashion, not to mention sophistication. All the protagonists of classical mythology survived or returned to carry the projections of just those aspects of our own personalities which we are least able or least willing to recognize directly within ourselves. And this is, of course, that conversation we had in a previous lecture about archetypes and about the cathartic nature of opera. We see in the characters in operas ourselves, and as a result, we suffer or experience emotional catharsis through the operas. Now, we know for a fact that the librettists such as Ottavio Rinunici, who wrote Peri's Eurydice, and Alessandro Striggio, who wrote Monteverdi's Orfeo, were powerfully influenced by another poet named Pierre de Ronsard. Ronsard instructed his fellow poets, too, and now I quote Ronsard, "Dissemble and conceal fables fitly, and disguise well the truth of things with a fabulous cloak, so as to make enter into the minds of ordinary people, by agreeable and colorful fables, the secrets which they could not understand when the truth is too openly disclosed." So this kind of purposeful symbolism of hiding truths within fables and fabulous characters is intrinsic to the opera and the art of this time. Donington concludes, "By Orphic doctrine, the sun is God and the moon, for God is day and night. I think this doctrine must convey an intuitive understanding of the two constants of our human destiny. First, that the masculine luminosity of the sun is complemented by the feminine numinosity of the moon. And second, that we most certainly have our dark sides as well as our light side, and that for the soundest of psychological reasons, we have somehow to accept both these polar opposites as part of that curious package deal, which is the human being," unquote. Now, all of this from that little chorus? Yes, all of this from that little chorus. Which brings us to the next episode in our opera, A Dance and Song of Celebration of the Upcoming Marriage. A joyful and pastoral song and dance follows prayerful chorus, which followed our prologue, which followed our toccata. Already we should be becoming aware of the extraordinary synthesis we are witnessing. Different kinds of music, all brought together and held together by the extraordinary dramatic line of the story. We started with the instrumental toccata. We immediately went to the prologue with its marvelous ritornello. Then we went to the recitative, very personalized, very melodic. Then we went to the chorus, very symbolic in its meaning. And now we go to a pop song and pop dance episode. The music of this song and dance, Lasciate I Monti, that is, Leave the Mountains, is in three parts. In part one, the voices, the dancers, and by the way, this would be danced at most performances, successively enter in canon. A canon, like Row, Row, Row Your Boat, is when each individual voice or group of voices comes in a period of time after the last one. And the beauty of starting a dance this way is obvious. Each dancer comes on stage with their music until finally everyone is on stage and in position. So let's listen to part one of Lasciate I Monti. Leave the mountains, leave the fountains, fair happy nymphs, and in these meadows with your usual dances, bestir your beautiful feet. This is part one of this song and dance, and I would also point out it's in what we call four. That is, we would count four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Listen. All right, part two of Lasciate I Monti. Everyone is now in position, and they sing. Here, let the sun, oh, there's that sun again. Let the sun watch your dances that are much lovelier than those which the stars in the sky perform around the moon in the dark night. So again, the celebratory tone continues. I would point out that Monteverdi switches the meter from four to three. We go from one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, two, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. It's a wonderful bit of metric movement. Part two. And part three of Lasciate I Monti is a rollicking instrumental ritornello which continues this triple meter. Part three. And we will hear this sequence of events three times. First, the dancers will enter in canon, singing in four. Then we will hear part two, sung in three, and then the instrumental ritornello. And then that sequence, with a couple of small changes, will be heard again. Please, the progression continues. The sense of celebration and excitement grows with each new number. Let's listen to this entire song and dance, Lasciate I Monti. We should be excited, we should be tapping our toes, and we should be prepared now for a very important event. And Monteverdi has led us right to the edge. And what's that event? Well, it's time to hear from Orpheus and Eurydice. We are primed and ready. All our blood's moving. It's time for the star couple to come out and sing for us. And sing for us they shall, but we will have to wait for the next lecture to hear from them. So with this in mind, we will conclude Act 1 and move on to Act 2 in our third lecture concerning Orpheus and Eurydice, Lecture 7 of our set. Until then, I thank you. Welcome back to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 7, the third of a four-lecture series entitled The Invention of Opera and Monteverdi's Orfeo. We continue in Act 1, and we continue with a signal moment. Finally, we hear and meet Orpheus and Eurydice. Orpheus is introduced, typically, by one of his shepherds. I say typically because Orpheus seems never to be without his shepherds. But you, gentle singer, whose laments once made this countryside weep, why do you not now delight the valley and hills with the sound of the famous lyre? May the testimony of your heart be some happy song that speaks of love. What's the shepherd saying? He's saying, how about a song, big fella? And indeed, it's a song opportunity, an aria opportunity, even though we don't really have arias yet, so should we say it's a recitative opportunity. Now, please, before I read the content of this recitative, I would just remind you that when we listen to this, you should listen especially for the fact that Orpheus's recitative is of an even higher melodic level than the ones we've heard the shepherds do up to this point. Again, that aspect of arioso, of almost song-like recitative, is especially true when Orpheus sings. He will have the most melodic material, and that makes great sense. He's supposed to be the golden-tongued singer after all. But please, let's notice these gradations of recitative that we hear in this piece. Again, Monteverdi's recitative is probably the best ever created. Orpheus sings to his Eurydice, who is at his side. Rose of the sky, life of the earth, and noble offspring of him who guides the universe. Sun, who surrounds and sees all from your path among the stars, tell me, did you ever see a happier, more fortunate lover than I? Blessed was the day, my beloved, on which I first saw you, and happier still the hour when I sighed for you, since you did return my sighs. Happy the moment when you gave me your white hand as a pledge of pure faithfulness. Had I as many hearts as the eternal heaven's eyes, and these pleasant hills, leaves in green May, all would be full and overflowing with the joy that has made me happy today. Eurydice responds, and please notice, they do not sing in duet as they might in a later opera. Rather, they sing consecutively. This is still a play that's been set to music. They're not singing concurrently in the sort of operatic duet that we have become familiar with, but which doesn't really exist yet. So Eurydice replies, I'll not say how great is my bliss, Orpheus, at your bliss. I do not bear my heart within me. It remains with you together with my love. Ask it if you would hear how it rejoices and how much it loves you. So they've spoken like good little cooing lovebirds, and immediately the joyful ballet music we heard before, Lasciate I Monti, returns, enclosing Orpheus and Eurydice's confession of love. And immediately after we hear the reprise of the ballet music, we hear a reprise of the chorus. Come, Hymen, O come, and let thy blazing torch be like a rising sun that brings days of serenity to these lovers. And so Monteverdi is recycling previously heard material, and it's a brilliant stroke, because what he does all at once is create a large-scale form within this first act. By bringing back both the celebratory dance music and the benediction of the chorus, we no longer have a series of discrete events, but rather a larger structure which we can perceive. And all of this, of course, is his doing. This is the composer as dramatist. Please, from the introduction of the shepherd to Orpheus's very melodic love song to Eurydice's brief reply, the reprise of the ballet, and then the beginning of the reprise of the Benedictory choral section. And so forth. The act comes to its conclusion moments later with a noble song of thanksgiving introduced in recitative by a single shepherd. And I would just read you quickly this introduction. But if our rejoicing comes from heaven, like everything else around us here, it is proper that we reverently offer it incense and sacrifices. Let each therefore turn his steps to the temple to pray to him in whose right hand the world rests, that he may long preserve for us this happiness. This brief recitative is followed by a really brilliant chunk of instrumental music, and I'm going to play it for you because it's so moving. It sounds, for all the world, like church music, and indeed, at this point, we must give thanks. And so Monteverdi writes a heavy, powerful ritornello. It's the theme that will come back and back again here at the end of the act, which at once reinforces the rural nature of this act, but also imbues the finale with a powerful sense of religiosity. I would also add, for people interested in such things, that this ritornello is a ricercare in five parts. That is, it's a piece of music built on a series of pitches that is heard lower and lower each time it's repeated in the bass. Now, again, this is a structural thing, a constructive thing that you won't hear on the surface. But these are the things that intrigue composers. How is this put together? And it's put together very carefully with great technical acumen. So let's just be aware of that, even if we don't hear it. Please, let's just listen. There's this wonderful and powerful church music introduced near the end of Act One. And after the hymn of thanksgiving, and after we've heard this church music a few times, the act concludes on another rollicking note of celebration. All right, some conclusions to draw about Act One before we move on to the second act. It is dramatically static. That is, there's very little real action. But that shouldn't come as a surprise. Most operatic Act Ones we're going to hear across the course of this course will be static. The job of Act One is what we've heard in the Act One here. It's to introduce us to the characters, introduce us to the essential dramatic information, which is the love between Orpheus and Eurydice. And in the case of this Act One, we are also introduced to this pastoral paradise of the outer world, filled with light and sun, which will stand, of course, in great polar opposite to the darkness of the underworld, which we will deal with later. The other point I want to make about Act One before we move on is what an incredible synthesis we have heard. I talked about this before, but we've got to drive the point home. We began with that blaring, blazing toccata, and now, of course, the blazing aspect of it, the sun-like aspect of that toccata becomes clear to us. Then we heard the ritornello-dominated prologue. Then we heard the shepherd's first recitative, and we got a taste of what recitative is going to be like when Monteverdi gets his hands on it. And need I remind us, this is Monteverdi's first opera. It's not that Monteverdi's been writing operas over and over and has perfected his craft. His craft is completely intact in the first opera. That is, this is something he does not need to work towards. He's already doing it better than anyone had done it, certainly, and better than most will do it for the next 400 years. After this opening recitative, we hear the symbolic chorus, that benedictory chorus. Then we have the ballet pop song, Lasciate I Monti. Then we have the love song between Orpheus and Eurydice, religious contemplation, and finally the unrestrained joy of the conclusion. That's a lot of stuff, and it all holds together because of Monteverdi's organization of refrain material that comes back and the incredible dramatic line that he creates. And it just keeps getting better, my friends, so let's continue, please. Act Two, Sadness and Grief Invade Paradise. Now, we wouldn't know that at first because at the beginning of Act Two, we have music that is as brilliant and as joyful as anything we heard in Act One. So initially, the spirit of Act One continues. Orpheus says, "Behold, I return to you, dear woods and beloved hills, made blessed by that sun, though which alone my nights, through which alone my nights turn today." So again, the brilliance of the sun is mirrored in brilliant and upbeat music. And we go through a whole long number celebrating the sun and how good everyone feels, until finally, after this number, a chorus of nymphs and shepherds sings, "Then Orpheus, make worthy with the sound of your lyre these fields, over which wafts the aura of oriental perfumes." So again, the gathered throng is asking Orpheus to sing a number. You know, more and more, Orpheus is reminding me of a kind of Arcadian Elvis-type character. I mean, let's face it, he's the unofficial king of Arcadia. He's got this whole entourage of homeboys, of shepherds that wanders around and asks him to sing all the time. And frankly, Orpheus is a rock and roller, and the next tune we're going to hear is as close to rock and roll as you're going to get before 1954. So let's move and groove, my friends. This is Orpheus at the highest he will be. I was about to say aria, I have to hold myself back. It's a pop song that transcends pop song called Vi Ricorda, Do You Remember? And it's Orpheus, as I say, at his most joyful. He could win the heart of any one of us with this song, and he will. Sadly, it's his last joyful moment in this opera, and the high that he brings us to will make the fall that much more profound when it happens in just a few minutes. So let's enjoy the sun while we can. I would point out that this Vi Ricorda begins with a brilliant ritornello set in the rhythms of a Renaissance dance. We have an alternation back and forth of a group of six followed by a group of three. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3. Back and forth. A familiar sort of metric scheme for someone of his time, but it just adds lots of juice and rhythmic complexity to this dancing song. And here's what he sings. Actually, let's listen to the ritornello first. So there's the rhythm that I was talking about, and it does dance. It does boogie. All right, now he sings. Do you remember, O shady woods, my long bitter torments, when the stones responded to my laments compassionately? Say, did I not then appear to you more disconsolate than any other? Now fortune has smiled on me and has turned my woes into a feast. I used to live sadly and woefully. Now I rejoice, and those sufferings that I bore for so many years make my present joy all the more precious. Only for you, lovely Eurydice, do I bless my former torments. After grief, one is more content. After pain, one is happier. We really don't want to see happen what we know is about to happen. I mean, it's almost too good right now. Again, we talked about it before, Murphy's Law of Love. The higher you get, the farther the fall. I don't know what the particular number of that one is, but it's got to be out there somewhere. Please, let's listen to the entire Vi Ricorda, the energized climax of the good part of this opera is reached, and let's be aware of that marvelous dancing ritornello as it appears between each of the stanzas of the song.
Le mie lunghe aspri tormenti, quando i sassi a me lamenti, risponde al fatti pietosi. Ti ricorda, o boschi ombrosi, ti ricorda, o boschi ombrosi. Sembrai di già allora non vi sembrai più d'ogni altro sconsolato, or fortuna è stil cangiato, ed ha volto in festa i guai, che ti allora non vi sembrai più d'ogni altro sconsolato. Vissi già me stretto lente, vissi già me stretto lente, or gioisco quegli affanni che sofferti ho per tant'anni, fan più caro il ben presente. Vissi già me stretto lente, vissi già me stretto lente. Sol per te, bella Euridice, benedico il mio tormento, dopo il tuol vi è più contento, dopo il mal vi è più felice. Sol per te, bella Euridice, sol per te, bella Euridice.
All right, we are at the moment when the messenger and the message she brings must come. So Monteverdi creates an incredible contrast between the happy shepherds and the approach of the miserable messenger. A happy shepherd continues to sing in rhyme immediately after Vi ricorda. Look, Orpheus, oh look how all around laughs the wood and laughs the meadow. So continue with thy golden plectrum to sweeten the air of such a happy day. And as our shepherd completes that bit of recitative, this is the music we hear the shepherd sing. It's very pleasant and it's very nice. And now I want you to hear what happens to the bass, because it twists up horribly at the anticipated approach of the messenger, and we should all say, oh no, bummissimo. Now listen. This chord becomes this chord. Oh, yuck. This can't be good news, and it's not. In the distance, we hear these words. Ah, bitter occurrence. Ah, wicked and cruel fate. Ah, unjust stars. Ah, miserly heaven. It is the messenger approaching from afar, and I would point out that the Italian is wonderful here. The words spill one into the next. Ai, causa cerbo, ai, fatto empio e crudele, ai, stella ingerose, ai, cielo avaro. That's good work on Strigio's part, to create words that just, oh, it's almost like one entire cry of pain. It is the messenger, and she approaches. Please, from this last bit of good feeling sung in rhyme by the shepherd, through that horrible upwards twisting in the bass and the shepherd's approach.
Mira de mi Orfeo, che d'ogni intorno ride il bosco e ride il prato. Segui tu col petto urlato, da dolci l'aria in giro.